It is time to begin the reading of today's Wall Street Journal for this Thursday, the 2nd of October, 2025. And with the Wall Street Journal today, we say hello and good morning to Ken.
Hello and welcome. In Wednesday's markets, drug stocks push indexes to highs. Pharmaceutical shares help lift major indexes to new highs on Wednesday. Pharma stocks climbed for a second session, extending gains that began after President Trump unveiled a direct-to-consumer website for Americans to buy drugs. Amgen and Merck both climbed more than 5% to push the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 0.1% to its second straight record. Thermo Fisher, Biogen, and Eli Lilly were among the top gainers in the S&P 500, which added 0.3%. Pfizer rose 6.8% and Johnson & Johnson added 3%, 0.3%. Stocks have hit record after record in recent weeks. Buoyed by interest rates coming down, earnings growth continuing to remain robust, and tax cuts poised to bolster corporate coffers. On Wednesday, the S&P grabbed its 29th record of the year and the Dow finished at its 9th record close. The Nasdaq composite rose 0.4% but finished shy of its record. The pharma gains helped investors look past the start of a federal government shutdown that could lead to a blackout of key economic data, including Friday's scheduled release of the jobs report. A prolonged government closure could push back the mid-October consumer price index. A look at private sector payrolls proved discouraging on Wednesday. Private employers shed 32,000 jobs in September, the ADP National Employment Report said. August's figure was revised down. The weak report removed any lingering doubt among traders about whether the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates this month. In an environment where we're uber-focused on the Fed and what the trajectory of their policy is going to be, not having key employment data puts investors on their back foot, said Liz Ann Saunders, chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab. Gold, which often thrives during times of uncertainty, rose 0.7% to $3,867.50 a troy ounce, a record and its fifth consecutive gain. Treasury yields declined, with the benchmark 10-year yield falling to 4.105%. Earnings season begins next week. With some official data sidelined, investors will be listening closely to what corporate America says about business conditions. If the early reports come in positive, investors might be patient for a bit longer about the shutdown delaying economic data. Shutdowns tend to raise noise more than change trend, said Larry Adam, chief investment officer at Raymond James. Since 1976, the S&P 500 has averaged a roughly 0.05% gain during shutdowns, according to Dow Jones market data. And a couple articles from the Herd on the Street page. Rates stand to help unloved bank stocks. Smaller financial institutions are finally poised to get a break. Things are shaping up for regional banks. Shares of smaller lenders have had a poor run against their bigger peers in recent years. The KBW NASDAQ Bank Index, which tracks 24 of the largest U.S. lenders, is up almost 20% so far this year. The KBW NASDAQ Regional Banking Index, which tracks 50 smaller lenders, is up only 1%. The performance gap was over 20 percentage points in 2024. Some of the biggest global banks are powering the large bank index. Shares of J.P. Morgan Chase, whose nearly $870 billion market value is more than twice that of the next bank, are up over 30% in 2025. Citigroup and Goldman Sachs are both up about 40%. Yes, those banks have seen record activity in their trading business as clients try to keep up with fast-moving markets. But the real backdrop to this performance gap has been high interest rates. Mid-sized banks can be more vulnerable to rising deposit costs, as they often are less reliant on vast stores of day-to-day checking accounts, and instead may rely on deposits from businesses, or may need to attract consumers with higher rate products such as certificates of deposit. Those customers are much more likely to seek out higher rates. Many regional lenders' businesses tilt less towards loans like credit cards or lines of credit to big companies, which have floating rates that rise as interest rates do. Instead, they are often more geared toward fixed-rate lending, particularly commercial property mortgages. So when interest rates rise quickly, their interest income is slower to ratchet higher. Fixed-rate loans drop in value. Now the tide is turning on rates. After an extended pause, the Federal Reserve resumed its cuts in September. The market expects further cuts at future meetings, and a new Fed chair will be appointed next year who may hew closer to President Trump's preference for low rates. Importantly, too many Wall Street strategists expect long-term rates to fall much slower or even rise relative to shorter-term rates, for reasons ranging from inflation expectations to concerns about U.S. fiscal policy and Fed independence from the president. Together, these forces seem likely to drive a steeper yield curve with lower short-term rates but steady or higher long-term rates. And that portends well for regional lenders. With falling shorter-term rates, regional banks that had to increase deposit rates can lower them. Larger banks, which already have super low deposit costs, won't see as much of a benefit. And fixed-rate loans that were a drag when rates were rising become an advantage as they fall. Analysts at Morgan Stanley estimated in a note this week that several of the regional banks they cover would see a boost to net interest income from 5 Fed rate cuts, including Ally Financial, Fifth Third, Huntington, Truist Financial, and Valley National. For many regional banks, one key ratio to watch is the difference between the yield on the 5-year Treasury notes and the overnight rate set by the Fed's targets. These are proxies for deposit costs on the liability side and loans like commercial property mortgages on the asset side. That gap is negative for now, meaning overnight rates are still higher than 5-year yields, although it has been getting increasingly less negative in recent weeks. If the Fed keeps cutting, it could turn positive again. The economic picture may favor regional lenders, too. Investors are seeing trouble spots emerge in lending to consumers and to other financial institutions. Both are dominated by big banks via credit cards and relationships with alternative asset managers. Meanwhile, things are starting to look up for pockets of business lending where regionals are strong. In commercial property lending, more borrowers may be ready to refinance. However, any lower loan pricing would need to be offset with a big boost to volumes or by borrowers leaving cash with the bank at a super low rate. Memories of what could happen if rates were to surprisingly reverse course and rise are also still fresh from the 2023 crisis marked by regional bank failures. But relatively small banks are already pricing in a lot of risk. Before the Fed began raising rates in early 2022, regional banks as a group often traded at a premium valuation to larger peers overall. Regional banks in the S&P 1500 traded around 14 times forward earnings earlier that year. Nowadays, they are far cheaper. J.P. Morgan trades at about 15 times forward earnings, and S&P 500 banks overall trade at 13 times. S&P 1500 regional banks trade at just 11 times. There aren't many things that are arguably cheap in today's market. A solid earnings season could be enough to attract investors back to regionals. A golden age for uncertainty. Government shutdowns aren't good for much beyond political point scoring, unless, that is, you own gold. Then, the ensuing disruptions can be uplifting. Not that markets have been lacking for political drama this year, and gold, which hit fresh records Wednesday, has already made plenty of it. Over the first three quarters, gold was up about 47%, trouncing the S&P 500's rise of nearly 14%. A weak dollar and the start of a new easing cycle by the Federal Reserve have helped drive the gains. Silver has done even better, rising 60% over the period. The shutdown, depending on its length and severity, could add additional luster to this run. For investors, the precious metal has tended to act as a hedge against a range of undesirable things, including inflation and debasement of the dollar or other currencies, but also political turmoil and general uncertainty. This is partly due to its non-political nature. Unlike treasury debt, gold's value isn't tied to any sovereign power. So, particularly at times when the U.S.'s preeminent position in global finance has looked vulnerable, gold has done well. Even before the shutdown became reality, the possibility of one had helped push the gold price higher. Gold reached a previous cyclical peak in September 2011. That happened after Standard & Poor's downgraded the U.S. credit rating following the long debt ceiling conflict between congressional Republicans and then-President Obama. The case for silver, or indeed platinum, which is up around 75% this year, is slightly different. These precious metals share many of the special attributes of gold, but also have real-world industrial uses. This means they tend to perform best when monetary policy is being loosened, but the underlying economic situation still isn't terrible. That seems to be the case now. But as a bulwark against serious downturns and catastrophic risks, they don't perform as well as gold. In April, when tariff fears were at their peak, the ratio of gold to silver prices reached high levels that have historically served as a strong buying signal for silver. Since then, silver has gained around 40%, closing much of that gap. The case for gold, meanwhile, remains intact. True, as an inert substance, it will almost certainly underperform stakes in productive growing companies over a long-term horizon. Still, it has a solid record of handily beating stocks when things seem to be going sideways, including in the 1970s and the first decade of this century. This is why many advocate a meaningful allocation to gold in investor portfolios, perhaps 5 to 10% as a hedge. Whatever one thinks of the second Trump administration's record so far, it seems a fair bet that uncertainty of all kinds is likely to remain high. That, in turn, makes the argument for holding gold hard to ignore. Automakers brace for EV slump. GM, Ford, Hyundai plan to keep offering promotions for battery-powered cars. Automakers are scrambling to unload lingering electric vehicles on dealer lots around the country now that the $7,500 tax credit that juiced EV sales for years has expired. The EV credit, which expired Tuesday, has lifted battery-powered car sales for years. Without it, Ford Chief Executive Jim Farley predicted, EV market share will fall by more than half to between 4% and 5% of total sales by the end of the year. We expect a pretty deep fall-off, Farley said on the sidelines of a company event in Detroit. Christian Meunier, chairman of Nissan's Americas region, said October should be the worst market in years for EVs. Manufacturers are going to have to push cars away because demand is not going to be there, he said. Dealers have about 134,000 unsold EVs, according to the latest data from Cox Automotive. At the current rate of sales, that means dealers will need 2 months to sell off the remaining supply. EV sales were scorching in the final months of the tax credit, lifted by deals that in some parts of the country allowed customers to snatch up an EV for as little as $39 a month. Electric models represented an estimated 12.2% of retail sales in September, up 2.6 percentage points from a year earlier for a record share, according to J.D. Power, an industry research firm. Spurred by the EV surge, overall sales are on pace for a slight increase from a year earlier, J.D. Power said. General Motors said Wednesday that 2025 is on pace to be its best-selling year in a decade, with sales up 10% through September from a year earlier. GM's third-quarter sales were boosted by a record number of EVs, 66,501, as consumers rushed to lock in the tax credit. Ford sales rose 8% in the third quarter, helped by records for its EVs and its hybrid vehicles. Toyota and its luxury brand Lexus, which have mostly avoided fully electric models in favor of hybrids, enjoyed a 14% bump in September, bringing total sales 8% higher for the year so far. Despite having one of the highest tariff bills in the industry, Toyota has kept its prices steady, seeing an opportunity to gain market share, said Damon Rose, vice president of sales for the Toyota brand. The 27.5% tariff the company is paying on Tacoma pickups imported from Mexico and on RAV4 crossovers from Canada is unsustainable, and the company is eager to see an updated North American trade pact, he added. We do think there'll be some industry price increases. We've been monitoring and tracking that. But from a Toyota perspective, we're going to be followers to that, not first movers, Rose said. Hyundai's EV sales doubled in September as the company reported a 14% increase in total sales. Randy Parker, chief executive of Hyundai Motor North America, said the brand is offering $7,500 discounts on remaining 2025 model year EVs, and for 2026, it is cutting prices on the Ioniq 5, its best-selling EV, by as much as $9,800. This is part of our long-term EV strategy, including U.S. production and focus on growing market shares in the United States, Parker told reporters. The Ioniq 5 is assembled in Hyundai's new facility near Savannah, Georgia. For years, Ford and crosstown rival General Motors have been building up a supply chain to support the rollout of numerous EVs, only to see consumer demand dry up and federal support for the technology wind down. EV growth stagnated in the U.S. partly because of high sticker prices, even with the tax credit factored in. The average EV sold for upwards of $57,000 in August, over $9,000 more than a comparable gas-powered car, according to Cox Automotive, an industry research firm. Ford and other automakers have recognized that they need to significantly rein in the cost of EV production if they are ever going to succeed in the U.S. Ford recently unveiled a $2 billion project to overhaul a Louisville, Kentucky factory to build a new line of affordable high-tech EVs. The first model, a $30,000 pickup, is expected in 2027. It's going to be a vibrant industry, but it's going to be smaller, way smaller than we thought, Farley said. Meunier, the Nissan executive, said he thinks other automakers will need to lean on promotions to sell down remaining EVs, likely keeping sales artificially swollen until the end of next year. You'll still see quite a lot of sales because of what has been built, he said. Ford and GM said Tuesday they would both keep incentivizing battery-powered car sales to help contain the fallout of the credit ending. A GM spokesman said the company is working with dealers on a way to extend the $7,500 credit for leases for an unspecified time. Reuters reported Monday that the automakers were signing up dealers for programs that would effectively extend the credit. Ford said it is working to provide EV shoppers with a competitive lease payments through its finance arm until the end of the year. Farley acknowledged its promotion will require significant financial support from Ford. The company expects to lose about $5 billion in its EV business this year. I don't want to imply at all that those kinds of programs are going to last forever, Farley said. It's a transition. Walmart scraps artificial dyes. Walmart is taking the biggest step yet to overhaul ingredients used in America's food supply. The country's largest grocer said Wednesday that it was working to remove synthetic dyes from all its store brand food, including Great Value Market Side, Freshness Guaranteed, and Better Goods. Walmart also plans to eliminate 30 other ingredients ranging from certain artificial sweeteners to preservatives. Many big food companies are working to shift away from artificial ingredients in packaged goods as the Trump administration and its Make America Healthy Again movement take aim at processed food. Walmart's heft makes its plans likely to trigger further changes throughout the nation's food supply chain, from ingredient suppliers to other food makers and retailers. Great Value alone is one of the largest consumer brands in the country, with billions of dollars in sales each year. U.S. consumers have shifted more of their food spending to store brands in recent years as they try to save money. Retailers are boosting investment in their in-house brands, with Walmart last year launching Better Goods, a food line with trendy flavors and more natural ingredients. Amazon.com on Wednesday debuted a new private label food brand called Amazon Grocery, combining products currently sold under the e-commerce companies Amazon Fresh and Happy Belly brands. More than 1,000 items will be sold under the new label. Amazon said including eggs, honey, potatoes, rice, and brownies, with most priced under $5. Walmart said its ingredients changes will affect products, such as sports drinks, cake frosting, and cheese dip, with some changes already showing up on its shelves. The retail giant plans to nix ingredients including titanium dioxide, a food coloring, and azodicarbonamide, used to help bread rise consistently. Walmart said it is working to keep its prices in check despite the ingredient changes, which are set to wrap up by January 2027. For years, Walmart's customer data has shown that more shoppers want simple, natural ingredients, said Scott Morris, Senior Vice President for Food and Consumable Private Brands at Walmart U.S. More than 50% of Walmart shoppers now flip over a food package to look at ingredients, he said. The customer is just getting louder and louder on this, Morris said, adding that some changes have been in the works for years and that natural ingredients are more available now than they have ever been. Walmart plans to tweak more than 1,000 products across its stores gradually, in part to give ingredient suppliers time to meet its volume and cost needs, Morris said. Supplies of natural ingredients are still constrained but growing. We feel like we can continue to be a catalyst with that demand as well, so that we can get the cost proposition exactly where we want it, he said. Food companies for decades have worked to use more natural ingredients as shoppers shun artificial versions. Target's largest private label food brand, Good and Gather, was launched 6 years ago without ingredients like synthetic colors and artificial sweeteners and flavors. Those efforts have accelerated as Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has spearheaded a push for deeper changes in a bid to tackle America's chronic health problems. Kennedy has called on food companies to remove all synthetic dyes, which he has said are poisoning American children. The latest Make America Healthy Again report, a signature document for the Trump administration, said the government aims to establish a national definition for ultra-processed foods and restrict use of federal food assistance programs for junk food. The food industry has defended the safety of widely used dyes and other ingredients in Kennedy's crosshairs. Since June, however, a string of big food companies, including Kraft Heinz, General Mills, and Nestle, have pledged to remove synthetic dyes from their U.S. products. Tyson Foods has said it would nix the dyes from its branded products, and last month also pledged to stop using high fructose corn syrup along with other preservatives and sweeteners. Replacing artificial ingredients hasn't been easy or cheap, and in some cases, shoppers have rejected new versions of popular brands. General Mills learned in 2016 that shoppers weren't fans of a new Trix cereal made with all-natural ingredients, including dyes derived from radishes, purple carrots, and turmeric. It quickly reintroduced Red 40 and Yellow 6. Excuse me. Mystery shrouds will of late Zappos CEO. Attorneys for tech entrepreneur Tony Hsieh's family have searched his calendar, dug through business records, and reviewed estate planning documents for any clues about the origins of a mysterious will that surfaced earlier this year. Among the few details they have uncovered are postmarkings on two envelopes that arrived at a Las Vegas courthouse earlier this year related to the purported will, the attorney said in a filing last week. One envelope was mailed from Greenwich, Connecticut, with a Las Vegas return address. Another was mailed from Fairless Hills, Pennsylvania, with a return address in Cheyenne, Wyoming. More than 4 years after Hsieh's death, the future of his $500 million estate remains mired in a legal battle further complicated by the arrival of the purported will and related letter. Hsieh's family has spent years fending off financial claims from former friends and colleagues who argued the entrepreneur had owed them money. Hsieh, who struggled with mental health concerns as well as drug and alcohol addiction in the final year of his life, left behind thousands of sticky notes on the walls of his Park City, Utah mansion. Some promised millions of dollars for a variety of ideas and real estate projects. On Tuesday, a judge in Las Vegas appointed two attorneys named in the purported will, Robert Armstrong and Mark Ferrario, as special administrators of the estate. That gives the pair the ability to act as advocates for the will, the judge said. It's odd, Judge Gloria Struman said of the will at a hearing, but it doesn't mean it's not valid. It's just odd. Anyone who wants to contest the purported will has 3 months after the judge's written order is filed to come forward. The entrepreneur's father, Robert Hsieh, has been managing his son's estate since his 2020 death, when it was believed no will existed. On Tuesday, Struman said she wasn't prepared to remove Hsieh as the estate's administrator, just given this very odd circumstance we find ourselves in. The purported will includes a no-contest clause addressed to the late entrepreneur's family. If any of his four remaining family members decides to fight Hsieh's wish, all of them will receive nothing. It transfers more than $50 million in several Las Vegas properties to a series of trusts whose beneficiaries remain unknown. In the court filing last week, Richard Hsieh's attorneys spelled out their investigation of the documents to date. They said they have found no information about the witnesses who signed the document, other people named in the purported will, or two trusts named in it. One of the witnesses responded to an inquiry from the Wall Street Journal through an encrypted email listed in an April filing. The person acknowledged acting as a witness a number of years ago. That person didn't respond to further questions. The other witness couldn't be reached for comment. The will was mailed by a man who identified himself as Kashif Singh. He claimed to have found the will in the possession of his grandfather, Pir Muhammad, who had dementia when he died. Richard Hsieh's attorneys said they have also been unable to locate Singh. Sheesh's attorneys also disclosed that since 2020, they had received and reviewed estate planning files from several different attorneys that the former Zappos chief executive worked with when he was still alive. None of the files included signed estate planning documents or made reference to the purported will, the attorneys said in the filing. Armstrong wasn't involved in estate planning with Sheesh and had never met him. But shortly after learning he was named in the surprise will, he said in a court filing he received a call from a man who identified himself as Singh. Shortly after, in June, Armstrong said he was provided a copy of a death certificate for Muhammad and included it in a court filing. The document states that Muhammad died in October 2022. The torrent of inflows to ETFs is showing no sign of stopping. Investors are putting more money than ever into exchange-traded funds, and Washington just took a step that all but ensures the billions will keep flowing. U.S.-listed ETFs took in a net $917 billion through September 29th, according to FactSet. If that pace holds during the fourth quarter, when inflows tend to pick up, it will be the market's second straight record year. In 2024, ETFs added $1.1 trillion. ETFs, which trade like individual stocks and boast certain tax advantages over mutual funds, emerged in the 1990s as a cheap and efficient way to keep up with gains in the stock market. This year, bullish and cash-rich investors and their interest in A new regulatory development could be the next major tailwind. On Monday, the Securities and Exchange Commission said it intends to grant so-called exemptive relief to dimensional fund advisors to offer funds with dual share classes, meaning that dimensional could add an ETF share class to an existing mutual fund. Industry executives expect the SEC to approve other dual share structures, potentially opening the floodgates for more money to swap from mutual funds to their more tax-efficient cousin. ETFs have pulled market share from mutual funds for years thanks to several structural advantages, but a long-time mutual fund holder sitting on large unrealized gains would need to pay taxes to swap fund wrappers. That is set to change. The way that we've applied for exemptive relief means that investors can convert from the mutual fund share class to the ETF share class in a tax-free way, said Gerard O'Reilly, co-chief executive at Dimensional Fund Advisors. This is a big deal. The dual share class model ETFs swelled to a record at the end of August. Dual share class or not, the ETF market has been on fire in 2025. Total assets in the U.S. ETFs swelled to a record $12.19 trillion at the end of August, up from $10.35 trillion at the end of last year, according to data provider ETFGI. Two familiar names are on top of the fund flow leaderboard: Vanguard's S&P 500 ETF and BlackRock's iShares Core S&P 500 ETF, whose ticker is IVV. These index funds, along with a similar offering from State Street, have combined for almost $140 billion in net inflows this year through late September, or close to $1 billion a trading day. Some of the fastest-growing segments are relatively exotic. BlackRock continues to rake in money with its iShares Bitcoin Trust ETF, which tracks the price of Bitcoin. Launched in early 2024, IBIT is the fastest-growing ETF of all time. BlackRock generates more revenue from the fund than all of its larger offerings, thanks to a modestly higher 0.25% annual fee. The fund has taken in nearly $24 billion this year, putting it fifth among all ETFs. Also popular are some relatively new strategies focused on dampening the effects of stock volatility and producing dividend income. Popular offerings include funds from J.P. Morgan Asset Management that invest in large-cap stocks while selling options contracts on those shares to generate higher dividend income than is typical in a stock fund. While the funds can damp the effects of volatility, they can miss out on some gains when markets are going up fast. Derivative-based strategies also include so-called structured protection funds, which insulate investors from a set amount of losses, in some cases up to 100%, while capping potential gains. Such strategies have grown more popular as financial advisors work to achieve specific outcomes and risk levels as their baby boomer clients, part of the wealthiest generation in history, retire en masse. We're starting to see more and more advisors moving away from the traditional 60-40 portfolio, said Matt Kaufman, head of ETFs at Calamos Investments, referring to the strategy of investing 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds. They're moving a lot more into alternative strategies, both for risk management and for income. Funds that employ options or other types of derivatives are considered actively managed. Once a tiny segment of the ETF market, active funds have boomed in recent years after a SEC rule change in 2019 made them easier to launch. Issuers have rushed to cash in with fund launches. While most assets are still in passive funds, the number of active ETFs surpassed the number of passive funds for the first time in June. While active ETFs now make up close to 10% of the market's assets, they took in 37% of the year's total inflows through July, according to Morningstar. Active funds provide a lot of really cool tools to provide the level of customization that clients want, said Brett Sheely, head of ETF specialists at AllianceBernstein. We're seeing real demand for that, and obviously it's showing up in the flows. America's dog-loving capital has had enough of your pooch. In San Francisco, pets roam sports bars, cafes, and gyms, licked during sit-ups. Rose Sorelli loves dogs. The violinist grew up with sled dogs in Alaska. She stops to pet dogs on the street. If she had to rate her love on a scale of 1 to 10, it would be a 10. But Sorelli, 29, has started thinking maybe San Francisco is too dog-friendly. While she and a friend were having coffee at Alamo Square Park, the pair were approached by five different off-leash dogs in an area that requires dogs to be leashed. The final visitor, a golden retriever, sent Sorelli over the edge. It literally launched itself at my pastry and got its mouth all over it and covered it with drool, she said. The dog's owner saw the whole thing and kept walking. Virginia may be for lovers, but San Francisco is for dog lovers. It has sprawling green spaces, treats behind every shop counter, and beaches where canines can run and splash in the surf. But dog lovers, dog haters, and the dog neutral are finding themselves in an uncomfortable alliance against a contingent they say is exploiting the city's tolerance. Paws are up on the counters of coffee shops and no one flinches. Croissants are being stolen out of the hands of hungry diners by hungrier black labs. The aisles of Target and Trader Joe's are full of, quote, service animals that can't seem to recall much, if any, of their training. Ralph Migdal says locals increasingly expect to take their dogs anywhere, which he wouldn't mind if their owners watched them. The 63-year-old was on a mat doing sit-ups at his gym when someone's dog strolled over and licked him. I just don't think it's cool getting licked in the face at the gym, said Migdal. When he alerted the owner, who was on his phone, he said, "Sorry, dude." Chandra Wilson moved to San Francisco in part because of its embrace of dogs. The biotech worker owns Clementine, a dash hound with 64,000 Instagram followers. She takes Clementine everywhere she's permitted, including restaurants and clothing boutiques. They went to the zoo, it was dog day, and several people commented that Clementine was better behaved than the children. Wilson expects Clementine and other dogs to have basic etiquette. A few months ago, at a San Francisco Target, she observed behavior unbecoming of a service pet. "I saw the dog poop on the floor," said Wilson, 33. People were a little gobsmacked. The manager of a local Trader Joe's said the volume of dogs walking the aisles is out of hand. Claire O'Malley, who works in finance and moved to the area from Chicago, isn't a dog owner, but has found San Francisco to be the most dog-friendly city she's ever seen. "I was not expecting dogs in a sports bar," she said. While outside a coffee shop with a friend and petting a dog, O'Malley, 33, watched two black labs approach, looking so sweet and unassuming. In a flash, one leapt up and snatched a croissant out of a man's hand. O'Malley says the owner confessed it wasn't the first time. The barista had also witnessed the move before. "It's like a thing," says O'Malley. "That dog is known for snatching croissants and being innocent about it." As president of the board of Lafayette Park's volunteer group, Stefan France gets wind of all kinds of dog complaints. France, who also lives across the street, said it's not uncommon to hear unchecked barking or for people to be on their phones as their dogs wander off in areas that require leashes. "The social contract of dog ownership has eroded over time," he says. "Dog owners once respected one another, but COVID ushered in a new era of entitlement. In the old days, it felt like if your dog was misbehaving, a group of people would come to you and be like, 'Hey man, that's not cool,'" said Franz, owner of Aru, a German Shepherd mix. "Now I feel like everybody turns their back." Dog walker Chris Laraway rarely sees dogs misbehaving. "San Francisco dogs are just fine," he said. "It's the people who are overreacting." He takes dogs into local establishments and events. Often, staff invite them in. A woman did once yell at him when a 50-pound Bernedoodle jumped onto a bed at an estate sale. "It's not like I let him do it," he says. "He's being a dog." Gina Gill, a local dog trainer, is torn. She wants dogs to live their best lives, but thinks some owners need to take more ownership. One time, while at Dolores Park, a friend described to Gill how a group of tech bros celebrating a birthday circled around an expensive-looking cake. Just as they finished singing, a small dog rushed the cake and took a bite and ran off. "It was my dog," Gill said of her mini poodle lab Shih Tzu mix. "I don't bring my dog to the park anymore." Student loan debt is strangling Gen X. Borrowers hoped for upward mobility. Many were left instead with regret. "I'm going to be working until the day I die." One of the most enduring relationships of Rick Benicour's adult life is with his student debt. The federal loans have followed him for more than 26 years, longer than he's been married. While his family has doubled with the addition of two children, his $74,000 in graduate school debt has more than quadrupled to $300,000. When the 55-year-old New Jersey chiropractor looks at his current balance, he is stupefied. He's made enough payments towards the loan throughout the years to cover the initial amount he borrowed, but it's been buried in decades of mounting interest. His balance continues to accrue interest, and repercussions, most recently the denial of a home equity loan application. Decades of payments meant Bentecourt wasn't able to save for retirement until later in life. Today, he has a little over $200,000 saved, a fraction of the 7x1 salary Fidelity Investments recommends workers have by 55. Gen X is barreling towards retirement with an excruciating student loan burden. The 6 million plus borrowers aged 50 to 61 have the highest average balance of any age group at $47,857, according to federal student aid data. Now, as parents and grandparents, they are passing along a skepticism towards higher education and its hefty price tag, part of the broader unraveling of America's college for all ideology. The oldest Gen Xers were born in 1965, the same year the Higher Education Act created the modern student loan system. The baby boomers, older than them, didn't have the same access, and the millennials, younger than them, had greater awareness of the long shadow debt can cast. But for a brief window, when the forgotten generation was reaching college age, student loan conveyed all of the promise of American upward mobility with none of the pitfalls. Back then, college was a must, said Benacour. You were either going to college or sweeping floors. Decades later, the promise is an albatross for many, and it's becoming more burdensome as the instability of America's student loan apparatus comes into sharp focus. The Education Department, under President Trump, has threatened to confiscate wages from millions of borrowers if they haven't made payments since the pandemic, when the Biden administration extended the pause on student debt repayment. A new tax and spending law, signed in July, restricts some borrowing and repayment plans, marking a retreat from federal student lending. Repaying federal student loans is not a political football, it's the law, an Education Department spokesperson said. The Trump administration is providing borrowers with clarity and consistency. It has been a particularly jarring shift from the Biden era, when monthly loan payments for low-income borrowers were reduced and a sweeping student loan forgiveness plan briefly raised hopes for a reprieve before it was blocked. 10 to 15 years ago, it was widely accepted that student loans were a good form of debt, said James Cavall, Undersecretary of Education during the Biden administration. A lot has changed. Expanding access. The unpaid federal student loan balance has swelled to $1.66 trillion from $516 billion nearly 2 decades ago. For millions, the loans helped them earn degrees that lifted their earnings potential, making the debt burden more than worth it. But paying it down has strained borrowers of all ages. That wasn't what policymakers had in mind 60 years ago when President Johnson signed legislation that opened access to loans, allowing students to sign up for a degree without worrying about whether they could afford it. Bentecor, whose parents immigrated to the U.S. from South America when he was a toddler, was the first in his family to attend college. He got a full scholarship to study English literature at the College of New Jersey. Later, when he was deciding whether to go to graduate school, a tour guide at Life Chiropractic College West in California encouraged him to take out loans to finance his degree. I was excited, Bentecor said. I was looking at the education and what I was going to do with it, and I wasn't really thinking about the money. That money was especially free-flowing when he was a student. Federal loans went from being a tool for lower-income families to a standard way many people paid for higher education. A 1981 law had extended the loans to independent undergraduate, graduate, and professional students. Two other key changes came in the 1990s. The government introduced direct lending to students, signaling a shift from federally backed loans from private banks. Unsubsidized loans were also added to the mix. While available to everyone regardless of income, the loans put borrowers on the hook for interest accrued while they were in school. Since Bentecor's parents weren't helping him pay and he was pursuing graduate school, he was eligible for higher borrowing limits. Bentancur took the maximum allowable and added private loans to cover the rest. He wasn't alone. Between 1990 and 2000, when many Gen Xers were in college, student debt more than doubled, according to the American Council on Education. It also took on a longer life. When Bentancur opened his chiropractic practice in the early 2000s, a loan servicer advised him to put his federal student loans into a payment pause to get his business off the ground, he said. Bentancur focused instead on his private loans, which took about 10 years to pay off. He spent 15 years in and out of forbearance, deferment, and repayment on his federal loans. In the years when his business did well, he would make payments towards the debt. When money was tight, he was advised to pause or defer those payments. All the while, interest was accruing on his seemingly unchanged balance. His loans were held by Navient, one of the country's largest student loan servicers. Last year, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau banned Navient from servicing federal student loans, saying it misled borrowers, processed their payments incorrectly, and steered those who may have qualified for income-driven repayment plans into forbearance instead. The company agreed to pay a $120 million fine, but said it didn't agree with the CFPB's findings. Bentancur's federal student loan payments were always part of an income-driven repayment plan. Though he paid the recommended amount, it was never enough to beat the interest. He resigned himself to the idea that he'd be paying off his student loans for the rest of his life. Promise past due. In 2006, the federal government once again expanded borrowing, allowing graduates and professional students to take out loans up to the total cost of attendance. It coincided with a rise in non-traditional students seeking degrees. That included people older than 24, those employed full-time outside of school, and parents like Christopher Fasone. Fasone got his bachelor's degree in applied behavior analysis when he was in his 30s to help him as he homeschooled his son, who has autism. Nearly a decade later, he received an MBA, hoping it would advance his career. But the higher-paying roles he dreamed of slipped through his grasp because they required years of work experience, he said. Today, the 49-year-old lives in Marysville, Washington, and works in commercial pest control. He makes $80,000 a year and owes around $130,000 in student loans. Like many borrowers, he hasn't been paying his loans since the pandemic pause. He focused instead on paying off his car and other debt. When the pause ended last year and he failed to resume payments, his credit score dropped more than 200 points. Fasone was surprised when he received a notification saying he'd fallen 6 months behind. He put his loans in a 3-month forbearance. About 5 million of the 44.7 million student loan borrowers are more than 90 days past due, according to federal student aid data. Borrowers who are 50 and older are more likely than other age groups to be seriously delinquent, according to the New York Fed. Fasone said he regrets going to graduate school and taking out student loans. He has nothing saved for retirement and doesn't think he will be able to afford to buy a house. Now out of forbearance, he worries he won't be able to keep up with his monthly loan payments and may have some of his paycheck withheld by the government. Loan holders can instruct employers to hold up to 15% of a defaulter's borrower's paycheck. I'm going to be working until the day I die, he said. Spiraling debt. Now, decades into their adult lives, many Gen Xers have accumulated other types of debt, often causing student loan payments to fall down the priority list after credit card and auto and personal loans. The middle-age crunch of caring for both children and parents has added to the load. Gen X had a median non-mortgage debt of $26,207 as of this year, higher than all other generations, according to a lending tree analysis of people in the largest 100 metro areas. They also held the highest average credit card debt last year at $9,557, according to Experian. Courtney Greenstein's budget has been stretched thin by payments on credit cards, a personal loan, and rent. The 50-year-old senior employee benefits analyst also supports her two adult children who live with her. With little left over, Greenstein hasn't made student loan payments on her $40,000 debt since she finished her business degree in 2018, decades after first trying college. She had earlier pursued a pharmacy degree at the University of Connecticut, but soon learned that she didn't enjoy the field and failed out. By the time she went back to school, she was also juggling motherhood. "I took every student loan I could possibly take," Greenstein said. "Not only was it helping me pay for school, but it was supporting me and my family." If her wages were to be withheld over non-payment, she said, she would have to get a second job to make ends meet. On a $123,000 salary, she has barely been able to save for retirement. Amassing retirement savings has been hard for Gen Xers who launched their careers just as a shift in American work culture was beginning. They have navigated companies moving from pensions to employee-driven 401ks. The flattening of middle management and upheavals driven by globalization and tech. Student loans have only made it more difficult. And that's it for today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center, and I thank you for listening.